You're listening to a Clare FM podcast. Morning Focus broadcasts weekdays from 9am to 12 midday.
Now, my next guest has put pen to paper on a new book which he insists is not political, that despite the fact that he is one of the most notable politicians in the country. Michael Healy-Ray has spoken out on a range of issues in his tenure as a TD and local representative, but now joins us with a different hat on, the author. Michael Healy-Ray, good morning to you.
Good morning, Gavin, and good morning to our listeners, and thank you for allowing me the opportunity to be on your show.
You're very welcome as always, sir, and good to speak with you. This, you say, it's not a political book?
Well, it's not, and it's not a memoir or anything like that, because for the moment I'm not dead yet anyway. And what it is, I suppose, it's just ordinary, practical stories that I have from very nice people that I have had the privilege of knowing, many, sadly, who aren't with us anymore, that would have been customers that would have been coming in and out of my father and now my brother's public house, when I was going to school, when I used to be serving behind the counter. People, my real job in the real world is a digger driver, people that I'd have known through that work all of my life. And you see, if you try telling a joke or something funny, Gavin, it's not really funny if it's something you make up. Mm. But the real funny and hilarious things could be the simplest thing. For instance, I remember when neighbours of mine, when there'd be a pig being killed in the house, and sure, the pig, you know, going to the killing of a pig long ago, it was definitely as good, if not a lot better, than going to many of the weddings of today. Right? And I really mean that. Like, a good night killing a pig would be as good as a wedding or as any other celebration that I have ever known, because the characters that would be there, the, you know, the sort of banter, and of course then everybody would get a bit of the pig afterwards. It could have been a bit of the meat that would have been salted, brown meat that would come out of a barrel. You wouldn't get the likes of it in the best hotel in any part of the Western world. And we used to have great nights, and you know, it was simple stuff, if you know what I mean by that. But it was very, it would give you memories that nobody could ever take from you, and that were very enjoyable and life's experiences.
Sure.
So look,
you have another story as well. Sorry to cut across you, Michael. You have another story as well about, is it burying a leg?
Well, yes, again, and you know, I want to be respectful about this, because...
No, I understand, it's an extraordinary tale.
Well, it is, but the only thing about it is it's a true tale, and this is the way I'll put it to you. Sadly and very unfortunately, when a limb needs to be removed, the person has a decision to make, or the family, whether you want it buried or whether you want it incinerated. But one day, I was up in a machine. We had mobile phones at the time. I think they were after coming out. And I was contacted by a matron in a hospital that a patient had said, unfortunately, he had a leg being removed and he had no family member to do the job of burying it. And he was asked if he wanted cremated or buried. So he said that he wanted it buried.
Mm.
So the matron rang me. Now, the first thing I thought that it was maybe a wind-up, but I wasn't long realizing, no, she was telling the truth. So I told her, look, you know, I'm driving a digger every day. I said, I'll do it, of course, but I'll have to do it at a weekend on a Sunday, sir. She said, no problem. So myself and a number of friends, I was a little bit nervous about doing the job on my own, so I carried a few reliable friends. We went over, collected it, brought it home, had to find the family grave, and we duly did our job in a very proper fashion. We couldn't get a priest, but I got a very holy relative of my own, and we carried out the blessing. But by the time we were burying the leg, we had flashlights out. It was late at night on a winter's night, and here we were inside in a graveyard opening up a grave to bury a leg. So the moral of that story is, as a public representative and a person who likes to help out in the community, you could be asked to do anything at any time for anybody.
That's exactly what I was going to say. Are you, and perhaps to a wider sense, your family, are you the go-to for all sorts of requests? And is that a Healy-Ray thing, or is it a politician thing, if you get me?
No, I'll put it to this. I'd argue that it's not a Healy-Ray thing, because yesterday, for instance, I had a number of county councillors from around the country up at an Oireachtas committee that I was chairing, and I used my time when I was giving a little talk afterwards to those councillors to express the deep gratitude that I have and for the work. Everybody hears all the time about TDs and about senators, and of course they play a role and an important role and everything, but there is one group of people, whether they were town councillors as they were before when we had town councils until the last government abolished them, and county councillors. They do great work, Trojan work in my opinion. That is terrible, terrible important and very important to their communities. And many times that work goes unnoticed, you know?
Yeah.
And people don't realise the good work that is done by county councillors. And I don't care whether they're Fianna Fáil, Fine Gael, Sinn Féin, Labour, Independent. As far as I'm concerned, every one of them are playing what I would call a very valuable role in our society, and one that should never be underestimated.
They have cut back, as you referenced, though. There's a lot fewer councillors in Clare and in Kerry than there were 5-10 years ago. We'll have local elections where they'll be fighting for their seats again next year, but a lot of them would argue that they're not being valued in the way that you'd like to see.
Well, I would like to see the role being further enhanced, because I really believe that they are doing great work in our communities, you know?
Why did you write this book, to go back to that? I mean, why did you decide to share these stories?
Well, I'll tell you why. Because it was the last thing in the world in my mind, right? But what happened was Hill Publishers came to me and they said, would I write a book? And my initial reaction was absolutely, absolutely no way that I would not do so, right? So I told them then that I would, but only on the condition that they would give me a ghost writer to assist me. Do you understand?
Yes.
And they did that. They gave me a very, very excellent lady who was really brilliant. But there was one very odd thing about the writing of the book. I said that the only way I could do it was between the hours of 12 o'clock at night and 7 in the morning, because I was not going to do anything that was going to interfere with my political work.
You must have had a very patient ghostwriter.
Well, I did. In fairness, the girl was a saint, an absolute saint, and she really worked closely with me at those hours. I used to ring her maybe at 1 o'clock at night, and we'd stay at it for 3 or 4 hours, and she had her dictaphone. But then, you see, this is the gift of being a ghostwriter. Things that I would tell her, she'd ask me questions and prompt me to give more information than I might have been going to give. And it could have been a week later, she would have asked me more questions about the same subject. So, like, I'd be the first person to admit to you and your listeners, look, when I was 10 and 11 and 12, I couldn't write my name, you know? And because I was profoundly dyslexic. So I'm not any great author or anything like that. But the truth of the story was, yes, I had a lot of things in my head that when I got the flow going and when I got into it, I liked the idea of writing these things down, that they'd be there forever, you know?
Yes.
But like, it isn't that I'm any gifted person or anything like that. The exact opposite would be the case. But this girl brought it out of me, if you know what I mean by that.
I do indeed, but I mean, a lot of people might be wondering if you sharing of these stories, of this simple stuff as you described it a few minutes ago, is this to further boost the Michael Healy Ray brand, to keep your name in the headlines?
Oh God, absolutely not. Well, sure, come back to the question you asked me, why did I write the book? Sure, I never thought about writing a book. It was a
but then you did.
They did, and they asked me, and I said no, and they didn't take no for an answer, and they came back a few more times, and eventually I thought about it, and I was persuaded to write. Now, that's an awful difference between me making up my mind, oh God, yeah, I'm going to write a book. Writing a book was probably the last thing in the world on my mind, but like I say, I did it when it was sort of put to me to do it, you know?
You said sorry to cut across you, Michael, you said it's not a memoir or anything like that. You've got, there's plenty of life in the old dog yet. We don't know what's going to happen with elections or anything like that, but how much longer do you think you'll stay in politics?
Oh God, there's a very straightforward answer to that. You can't stay or be in politics unless people want to, whether you're a councillor or whether you're a TD or any type of a public representative. The only way you can be there is if the people want you. I will always stay in politics for as long as I can give it, not 100%, but 120%. And the day that I feel that I'm not giving it my 120%, well then, if I can't do a thing right, I won't do it at all, you know? And I like representing people. I'm very thankful and grateful. I always classify being a TD as that you are a servant of the people who elect you and who vote for you, and the people who don't vote for you, because you're there to represent them and their views and opinions as well, indeed. And as long as I can do that in a proper, hard-working fashion, I like it. I like being able to help people. You have good days, you have bad days. I recount in that book a time that I made a very big blunder. I made an awful mistake. The mistake that I made, it had disastrous consequences for an individual, and that individual lost his life. And I don't think you could make any bigger mistake. But again, I tell the story in the book, and you might say, why do I do so? Because when you're being honest and straight about things, you get plenty of politicians who will come out saying, well, you know, I did great, I did this or I did that or I did the other thing. Well, equally, when you're doing lots of things, you will make mistakes. I know that that's not the only mistake I've ever made. I've made a lot more of them. But I hope that with political experience that my mistakes are getting less, you know.
Sure,
but
yeah.
The mistake I made that time was purely, in my opinion, when I look back on it now, it was political inexperience at the time.
What happened exactly?
What happened was, would you mind me asking you a question, Gavin? What age are you approximately?
I'm 33.
You might be too young to remember this, but a lot of your listeners won't be. There was a thing in Ireland one time called non-bogus residential accounts.
Yes.
Now, what they were, it might sound like some very crooked thing altogether that people were involved in, but it wasn't. It was the most innocent thing in the whole world. At the time, banks and building societies were giving what you'd call good rates of interest, right? But people who went into their banks, they were told, oh, if you have a brother, Johnny, or a sister, Mary, in America or London, if you use their address, you can get far greater interest.
Yes.
Right? So people gave Johnny's address in London or whatever, and they got a great rate of interest. Right? So that was okay until Revenue copped onto this.
I remember,
and Revenue started investigating. But you see, the problem was, if you had 100,000 or 50,000 or 20,000 on deposit, and I don't blame Revenue, the Revenue people were just doing their job, right? So what happened then was, they wrote out to you, but what they were looking for was actually all of the money that you had on deposit, right?
Mm.
So a very nice man came to me, and he was in his 70s, and I have to explain this. He was living in a house that would have had very poor sanitation. It had maybe a tin iron roof on it, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, I can picture the type of home, yeah.
Yes, and a nice countryman, and he owed over 100,000, 120,000. So I got stuck at it anyway with Revenue, and I fought the case very diligently, and I brought the money down to something like 72,000. So I told him he'd have to pay that, and one night I was driving along the road, I was coming from clinics, and I was in my van, and the phone rang, and it was the man, and he said to me, Mikey, can you do any more for me? And this is the mistake I made. No, I said, no, not at all. I said, sure. And I don't want to say I was dismissive, but I know exactly the way I was. I was just very matter-of-fact.
I understand, yeah.
It'd be like, you asked me, was it raining? Well, it's bloody well raining, or it's not. You know, and I just told the man the truth. I said, no, I said, look, we're at the end of the line with this. I did what I could do. I can do no more. This is the Revenue. They will get the money, so you'll have to pay it. And that was fine. The man, he said, Michael, thanks very much. He said, but no, I won't pay it at all, he said. And there was something very definite about him, like that, you know, but I just dismissed it. And I said, look, for God's sake, Revenue is Revenue. You'll have to pay it. So the following day, I went away driving a machine, and the next day again after that, I was up on the digger, and the date came on Radio Kerry, and I heard the man's name being called out. Now, I obviously had to be careful not to divulge a confidence.
I understand, and I'm not... Yeah, yeah.
I rang a neighbour at that time, and I said, did I hear the dates right? Is such a man did? And he said, oh, God, yes. He said, sure, you should have known that man. He was in and out to a clinic too a lot of times. And we can't understand it. He said, he stood up on the kitchen table the night before last night and hung himself. So what that man did was, when I gave him no hope, and when I gave him no idea at all that we could do any more, he decided there and then, right, that's it. This man is telling me I'm at the end of the line. I will not pack with my life savings to revenue. So he decided to call everything off. Now, there was nobody responsible for that, only me. It wasn't anyone else's fault. You know, there is no one else involved. That was completely my inexperience that led to his death. And that's a regret. Mm. And it's like this. I can't change it. I can't change it. Believe me, I'd love to change it.
Yeah, of course not.
But it opened my eyes an awful lot about, you know, that you have to be so careful about doing the right thing and being right and, you know, being proper.
I think we all have instances, though, where we have unintended consequences. You weren't, and I hope it doesn't weigh too heavily on your conscience that, you know, you were genuinely had tried to help this gentleman. And
I did, but I made a boo-boo. But look, that's life, unfortunately. But I tell that story, and I don't want to be too serious with your listeners. But Ollie, you asked me the question about.
No, I understand.
You know, yes, there's funny things in the book, and then there's hard, tough things in it as well. Things that aren't nice. You know,
such as life,
but that's life. And you see, that's what I tried to tell in the book. It's stories, and look, stories. Sometimes stories can be good. Sometimes stories can be bad. But the only thing about it is, I know that an awful lot of people are looking at it and read it, and they seem happy with it. So look, all I can say to you, I wouldn't be the best salesman in the world, but if people are interested in hearing those sort of things. It is for sale in bookshops, and maybe it'd be a nice thing to buy. You know, if a person bought one of them for Christmas, and couldn't they share it around to friends and neighbours and things and family and things like that, you know?
Appreciate the honesty. It's called Time to Talk, Stories from the Heart of Ireland by Michael Healy-Ray. Michael, thanks for joining us this morning.
Thanks for having me on your show, and any time I'd be delighted. The people in Clare, by the way, are very nice. When I went to Palliskinnery Agricultural College, there was a lot of young people there from Clare, and around that area. And you know, the people in Clare and the people in Kerry, they're very grounded, they're very ordinary. There's no nonsense, there's no rubbish. What you see is what you get. And I really liked the people. There was one particular man there, James Neal, and he was a very fond friend of mine, a farmer from out in Corrifin, that direction. So I know a lot of people around Clare, and they were always very nice to me, and I appreciated that.
Very good. They're nice in the text too. Mary says she's delighted to hear you. Love listening to you on the programme this morning. Michael, all the very best. Thanks for your time.
Thanks very much.
Do take care. Bye-bye. Michael Healy-Ray there. It's Morning Focus here on Clare FM.
You're listening to a Clare FM podcast. Morning Focus broadcasts weekdays from 9 a.m. to 12 midday.